This sermon was delivered at Grand Avenue Baptist Church, a gospel-centered church in Ames, Iowa. Hear more sermons and learn more about Grand Avenue at gabcames.org.
All right, and we are going to go ahead and get started here. We are talking today, continuing in the series on apologetics that we're covering this semester in Adult Foundations. Today, I'm going to be talking about the 10 M's of apologetics. This is kind of something that the 10 M's are stuff that I came up with from my mind, but not a single one of these arguments, or I'll call them perceptions, is going to be something that I've made up. These are all things that others before me have noticed and developed, and we could go deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper on every single one of these. So each one of these could have an entire Foundation Sunday devoted to it, could have an entire book or an entire semester of a college course devoted to it. We're not going to go that deep primarily because I'm not that smart. Okay? But what we're going to aim to do today is cover the first five of these. So if you look at your handout, you'll see the first five blanks there have a, or the first five numbers have a blank and then a definition, and those definitions have some blanks in them. That's what we're aiming to work through today. And then for the second five, for perceptions 6 through 10, come back on May 3rd? Is that the two Sundays from now? May 3rd, we'll if you come back, we will cover the last five is the plan. Okay? So Dean, I believe last week started, or he covered some of the things at a kind of a in-depth level that we're going to touch on today, but I'm going to hit a couple of those from a little bit different angle as well. I have three goals, and this is where your blanks start. I have three goals of our time this morning. I'm hoping to accomplish three things by God's grace. The first goal is I'm hoping to persuade you that the Christian worldview provides the most coherent, comprehensive, and joyful explanation for why everything is the way it is. I want to persuade you that the Christian worldview provides the most coherent, comprehensive, and joyful explanation for why everything is the way it is. I also want to give you, goal number two, is to give you a few memorable ways to gently and respectfully attempt to persuade others as well. So a few memorable ways to gently and respectfully persuade others as well. Believe it or not, that word memorable is not the first M of apologetics. There's more M's that are going to be coming. So then the third goal I have, and probably my most important goal for today, is I want to persuade you, or I want to lead you, provoke you even, might be a good word to use. I want to lead you to worship. I want to lead you to worship. Okay? So the classic apologetics verse, I have it there in your handout, is 1 Peter 3:15. Would somebody be willing to read that out loud? Anybody want to give it a shot?
But in your hearts, honor Christ, the Lord as holy, always being prepared to make a defense of anyone who asks you for a reason for the hope that is in you. You do it with gentleness and respect.
Very good. Thank you. In your hearts, honor Christ, the Lord is holy. I feel like oftentimes this is a classic apologetics verse, and I'm bringing it here. Oftentimes the things that are emphasized in regards to apologetics in this verse are this idea of making a defense of your faith. And that's certainly what we're going to talk about in some sense today. And I think also rightly, a lot of apologists emphasize that last bit of the verse, to do it with gentleness and respect. They rightly emphasize that. That's good. But what I want to emphasize today is this idea of apologetics being for the good of your soul. It's for the good of your heart. So there, in bold there in your handout, it talks about, in your hearts, honor Christ the Lord as holy. Anyone who asks you for a reason for what? For the hope that is in you. Hope is something that happens in your soul. It happens in your heart. So these, according to Peter, these things that we use in our minds and our intellects to defend our faith, the reason for the hope that we have, that impacts our hearts. It doesn't just impact our intellect. So, getting down to the next blanks there, apologetics, I believe, apologetics rightly explained isn't just an appeal to your intellect. Apologetics rightly explained isn't just an appeal to your intellect, it's an appeal to your heart. Apologetics is an appeal to your heart. Apologetics rightly understood will provoke you to worship the living God. It takes aim not just at your intellect, but at your motivations, your desires, and your response. Does that make sense? It takes aim not just at your intellect, but at your motivations, your desires, and your response. So what we do with this information isn't just to somehow be smarter or to know more stuff. It's to be provoked to worship the Lord, to be provoked to draw others into this good news, into this hope that we have of eternal life, that this life does have some purpose to it, that things matter. That's also not one of the M's. Matter. That's not. We could have even added to this, right? All right. Let's see. I want to caveat with where we're headed here. These 10 M's, they start intentionally very, very broadly. So we're going to like zoom way out on a cosmological level. We're going to zoom way out. And we're not starting really fundamentally here with Scripture. We're starting with what we perceive in the universe. We're starting with what we see with our eyes, what we study with our minds. And where I'm getting that from, ironically, is Scripture. Romans 1:20 says, "For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and his divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made. So they are without excuse." Okay? So Paul is talking about here that we can see God's eternal power and his divine nature clearly. We can perceive that God is eternally powerful and that God has a divine nature. We can clearly perceive that simply by looking at creation and seeing what he has made. Simply by doing that, we are without excuse for believing that powerful, that eternal God exists. So, I think that leads me to think that science and faith are not at odds. All scientific understanding itself involves faith, and the more we study, the more it seems to me that the necessity of God is apparent. The more it's clearly perceived. The more we learn, the more we realize that we don't know. The more we learn, the more we can keep asking why and why and why, and we get to the bottom of it. There must be a first cause. There must be someone, something that is uncaused that provides that first cause. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Let's go to our first M. Our first M, the definition of it, is showing extreme care and attention to detail. Showing extreme care and attention to detail. The word there is meticulousness. Meticulousness. Okay, showing extreme care and attention to detail. The idea here, you can take notes under this point if you want to, is that we live in a Goldilocks universe. Dean talked about this a little bit, that the parameters necessary for this universe to exist the way it does, to exist in a way that would make any sort of conceivable life possible, those parameters are incredibly small. And there are many, many, many of those things that need parameters like that. Things like the strength of gravitational attraction. If that was just a little bit different, then everything is different. And by a little bit, we're talking about one part in like 10 to the 50th or something. If you know your exponents, that's a really big number. That's a one followed by 50 zeros, okay? The one that gets me is the value of the cosmological constant. Anybody know what the cosmological constant is? Anybody want to take a stab at it? The cosmological constant? Go for it.
Is that the speed of light?
No.
Oh.
But the speed of light is another one of these parameters. Yes. Anyone else want to take a stab? No? The cosmological constant is the value of dark energy that keeps the universe expanding. If the universe didn't have this dark energy in it, then it would just keep expanding, it would like crunch back in on itself due to gravitational attraction. And this dark energy is so important to keep the universe expanding it's so finely tuned, it's so dialed in that one, if it was off in one part in 10 to the 90th, one followed by 90 zeros, if it was off in one part in 10 to the 90th, the universe would expand too fast to form galaxies, or it would implode on itself into a black hole. It's absolutely perfectly tuned. To give you an idea of what that number is, there are about 10 to the 80th protons in the known universe. Okay, so this is like finding one single proton in the entire universe. Dean talked about that a little bit last week. Okay, I'm going to skip some of what I had here. I'd love to talk more about this, but I'm already running out of time. The point is, the universe appears to be designed by a self-existent, super-intelligent, creative mind, such that human life is able to exist. The universe appears to be designed by a self-existent, super-intelligent, creative mind to be fine-tuned in this way. One thing I want to pause and say here, this was brought up a little bit last week, as we talked about, you guys remember we talked about like the marbles in the box. If you were here last week, the marbles, do they shift to this side of the box or the other side of the box, the blue and the red marbles? If you shake the box enough times, it's going to end up, you know, in the way that shows a pattern, that shows meaning, right? You remember we talked about that, Andy? Or we talked about if you have enough monkeys typing on typewriters for long enough, one of them will produce Shakespeare. It's possible. Maybe, right? These arguments exist for how could the universe possibly be so finely tuned without God existing, without this super intellect finely tuning it. The point that I wanted to make here is that we're not looking for possible, conceivable other alternatives. What we really want to get to the bottom of is what is the best explanation for why everything is the way it is. Not are there conceivable alternative arguments that we can create in our minds, but what is the best, most reasonable argument for why everything is the way that it is. So that those are called abductive arguments, the inference to the best explanation, not conceivable alternative explanations. Okay. We'll keep building on this. The first blank, remember, or the first perception is meticulousness. The second one, let's go to number two. The second thing is the science of numbers. The science of numbers and their operations, interrelations, combinations, generalizations, and abstractions. Okay, that's just from the Oxford Dictionary. The word there is mathematics. That's the M for number two, mathematics, the science of numbers. Math, if you think about it, does anyone really like math in here? Wow, way more than I expected. Awesome. I thought you would say that, Gabe. I had a feeling about you. Have you ever really stopped to think about math? Yes. Have you ever just stopped to think about it and like that it is? Yes. Math is amazing. The more you stop and think about this, from a skeptical perspective, if you're coming from an atheistic perspective in your mind, hypothetically, just think about this. Math is invisible. You can't see, touch, taste, or feel it. Math is orderly, and it's beautiful. There's nothing haphazard about mathematics. Math is true. like objectively true, always. It doesn't matter where you are, who you are, or how you feel about math. Math is true. It's always true. That leads to math being immutable. It never changes. Math is always the same. 2 + 5 is always 7. Every single time. It's not going to be 9 next year or in 1,000 years. 2 + 7 is always 9. It never changes. Math is trustworthy. We all put our faith in math every single day. I even heard, I was listening to some report about the Artemis mission that, you know, they went and orbited the moon and then came back just a couple weeks ago. And one of the reporters said, as they're like re-entering the atmosphere, the reporter said, those 4 astronauts on that capsule, they are trusting the math that they will get home alive. I thought that was really interesting that the reporter said that's what they're putting their faith in, is the math. And there's a sense in which that's true. If the math was off, they're toast, they're dead. If someone did it wrong, they're all done. But it wouldn't be because the math changed. It would be because it was wrongly worked out by the human mind that took a stab at it. So my point is this. The last point here is math really exists. Seems to me, at least, that math really exists whether we're there to think about it or not. That the Pythagorean theorem really exists. It's always true, whether it's discovered by a mathematician or not. So the point is, even the most skeptical people believe in something that is real, invisible, true, and unchanging. Even the most skeptical people believe in something that really exists that is those 4 things. Sounds a little bit like God. God has some of those attributes, or he has all of those attributes, doesn't he? He has more attributes than that, certainly. Our God is not math, but math has some of those attributes that God has. But what can't math or science do? Cause anything, right? They can't make anything happen. Math never did anything. Math is just there. It's like it's a language that is there that describes somehow the fabric of reality. It almost seems like math is a window into the mind of God. And in fact, many theologians have spoken about math this way, that it's like a window into the mind of God, that by doing mathematics, whether at a low level math or like really high level calculus and beyond, that we're peering into the mind of the one who made all things to operate according to these laws and truths. Mathematics is the second one. All right, getting on to the third one. The definition is cellular organelles that produce energy for the cell through cellular respiration, are rich in fats, proteins, and enzymes, and have their own DNA. Have their own DNA. Anyone want to take a stab at what the M word is there?
Mitochondria.
Very good, Jack. Mitochondria. This is the one I had to force a little bit. I had to force it just a little bit. Okay, mitochondria. Cellular organelles that have their own DNA. That last point that right there is really the key to what I want to say here. Because Dean talked last week about the irreducible complexity of the cell. I'm not going to talk about that at all, though that's a really good point. The point I want to make today about mitochondria is they are organelles that are in each cell, in your body, in any living thing, that has mitochondria that have their own double-stranded DNA. Okay? Mitochondria have their own double-stranded DNA. There's also DNA in the nucleus of each cell, but mitochondria is another organelle that has its own DNA. The point here is that DNA is a complex language. Sometimes it's just talked about like it's just a basic molecule or something. DNA, there's nothing basic about deoxyribonucleic acid. I don't know if I said that right, but I tried. There's nothing basic about it. It's a complex language. And what do languages, in order to be useful, what does a language need to be? I don't know if that makes sense. Someone said it, yeah. Understood. A language needs to be understood or it's not of any value. So that means that not only does this DNA exist in the cell, but there has to be something in that cell that reads the language of the DNA and then makes something out of what it reads. It's amazing. Anyone have any idea if you stretched out the DNA in one of the cells in your body, one DNA strand, you uncoiled it, anybody have any idea how long it would be? No, not one strand of DNA, but you're getting ahead of me a little bit, actually. One strand of DNA from your cell uncoiled would be about 6 feet long. Okay?
Right there.
6 feet long. In each cell of your body is wound up this little language, this book that's read by ribosomes and different enzymes and things to produce proteins. It's crazy. It's crazy. Okay? If you linked all of your DNA strands in your body, from every cell in your body together, they would stretch from the earth to the sun and back 500 times. 500 times from the earth to the sun and back. That's language. That's code. Digital code is how biologists talk about DNA. And it's in your body. And it's functioning and doing stuff and making me talk and making you think, hopefully, if I'm talking right. It's amazing. Language, in my experience, has one known source. Any guesses? A mind, right? Language comes from a mind. In any conceivable thing I can think of, language that is written and then read and understood and produces an effect, language comes from a mind. I don't think it's unreasonable to think that DNA came from a mind as well. The best scientific explanation I can think of for the existence of the DNA molecule seems to be an intelligent creator. Okay, we're doing good. We're going to make it. Number four, an implication of special significance. The blank there is significance. Any guesses on the word, the M word there, for number four? Go ahead. Very good. Meaning. Yes. Meaning. Number four is meaning. An implication of special significance. Purpose. Significance. Things matter. People matter. You matter. You have value objectively. We all perceive this intuitively. This is like written into our DNA somehow to believe this, to feel this, to know this about ourselves and about one another. You have value objectively. You matter. You have meaning. We talked about this a little bit. Think about the monkeys trying to type out Shakespeare. Let's say they did it. Let's say they accomplished it. They typed out Hamlet. One of them nailed it. No typos. Nailed Hamlet. So what? What makes that different than the monkey that typed out nothing right before him, that typed out just gobbledygook? Nothing conceptually makes that any different. The only reason that Hamlet has meaning is because Hamlet has meaning. Is because it was created with purpose, right? Otherwise, there's nothing different about Hamlet that the monkey typed out than the monkey that just wrote a bunch of mush. None of it made any sense. Meaning is derived from a mind. Meaning is thoughtful. Hamlet is thoughtful, right? It came about by the intention of the brilliant creative mind of William Shakespeare. So if Hamlet has meaning, and it comes from the mind of a brilliant author, our lives have meaning. They appear to have meaning. We feel they do. Somehow intuitively we know they do. The universe appears to be created by a meticulously careful creator, such that meaning can be displayed and understood in the creatures that exist in that universe, is it most reasonable to deduce that this perception of meaning is a mass illusion that we all experience? Or is it most reasonable, is the best explanation for this perception that we have of meaning, to conclude that there actually is meaning? That there actually is an author, a creator? This feeling of meaning that we have is so strong that, to Dean's point in the sermon today, without it, we despair. We languish as human, as a species, without meaning. And that seems to be unique to our species. How interesting. Okay, so we're building. We looked at the parameters of the universe. We looked at the existence of invisible mathematics. We looked at the language of the cell in DNA. We've looked at meaning. The last point for today is number 5, greatness or splendor of quality or character. Splendor is the blank in the definition. Any guesses as to the M word? Very good. Majesty. Well done. Okay? Majesty is greatness or splendor of quality or character. Nature, I believe, is filled with majesty. Think of some examples: the Grand Canyon, clouds, lightning, sunsets, the northern lights, trees, flowers, birds, nebula, the night sky. All of these things, if you haven't been struck by the majesty of these things, you should be. And we could go on and on and on and on and on and on and on, right? With examples of things in the universe, in creation, that have majesty, that strike awe into us, that we go and we look at it and we say, that's majestic, that's mysterious, that's wonderful, that's awesome, right? Okay? Any questions on majesty? Is this making sense, what I'm getting at? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What would you say for the atheist who looks at life, where it is completely probabilistic, and it is so infinitesimally small, that it is the same joy as winning the lottery? So the reason you get joy from a very unlikely event is because it was unlikely, and yet it happened.
Yeah.
How do you distinguish these types of joys that the atheist would perceive? Life is beautiful because it's unlikely.
Yeah, beautiful because it's unlikely versus beautiful because it's designed. I'd go back to point number 4 in the meaning. So, unlikeliness doesn't lead to me having joy in something. Me winning the lottery is cool only because I won it. It's meaningful to me only because it happened to me. If, like, Jack over in, you know, in Bondurant, a different Jack, won the lottery, I'm like, okay, I don't care. It has no meaning to me. It has no bearing on anything. So just because it's unlikely that it happened to him, I'm not like, whoa, the guy in Bondurant won the lottery. That's amazing. That's majestic. Don't care, right? Because it doesn't have meaning to me. Is it only matters if it has meaning, I think. Yeah. Okay. So in the universe, I think we see stunning grandeur, stunning intricacy. We saw the intricacy with the DNA, stunning beauty. We perceive things that are majestic as beautiful. It's not clear why this would be the case in any sort of an evolutionary context. I don't think dogs experience beauty. They're not stunned when they see the Grand Canyon. Okay? This is a uniquely human experience it's not clear how this would be explained apart from a majestic creator wiring into us this ability to clearly perceive beauty in the things that have been made. Back to Romans 1:20. We're clearly perceiving majesty. Okay. We're at 11, so if you need to go and get kids, go ahead. We have like 3 minutes left. I taught on this little point I'm going to make a couple of years ago, and I'm going to do it again because it's probably the most amazing thing I know, like the most amazing scientific fact I know, okay? This is different. We're going to talk about the night sky for a second. Okay, if you're out there, look up at the ceiling and pick one of the knots on the wood. Just pick one. Look straight at that, okay? That little knot, that's what I want you to focus on in your mind. You can look back down again, but you can look up at it whenever you need to. Anyone heard of the Hubble Deep Field image? Anybody know what that is? The Hubble Deep Field image? Okay. Nice, good. You should Google it. Okay, the Hubble Deep Field image. This is a picture taken by the Hubble Space Telescope in 1995. They sent this telescope up into space. They thought, let's look at a super dark part of the sky where there's really not many stars or anything and just see if there's anything there. So they pointed the telescope at this one spot in the sky. The spot happens to be about the size of one of the knots that you were looking at on the ceiling. Okay, that's what they were zooming in on. And they pointed the telescope at it for 10 days straight. Collected all the light that came in and made an image. And they discovered that inside of that little knot space on the sky is approximately 10,000 galaxies. Galaxies. So if you zoom in on any part of the sky, all the way around you, down, you could go through the earth, 360 degrees all the way around the globe, and you zoom in on that little knot, 10,000 galaxies exist in that patch of sky. That's the Creator who loves you. That's the Creator who made everything. He exists, and He is majestic. He created something so vast, so mind-blowingly huge, and yet He became one of us. He became like us, and He took up a cross to pay the penalty for our sin. I'm getting way ahead of myself in terms of our outline here. We haven't, by no means does the majesty of the universe prove that Jesus is the Messiah. That's not the point I'm trying to make, but I'm applying it to us as Christians before we go home today to say that's the majesty of the God you serve, is that He is able to make trillions of galaxies, each galaxy containing like 200 billion stars on average. 200 billion stars per galaxy. And there's something like 3 trillion galaxies in the known universe. Our minds don't even work. We can't comprehend the scale, but God is bigger above all of that. And there's good reason to believe why He exists, why He is there, why He is the majestic one behind the majesty that we clearly perceive in the universe. Okay, so technically we haven't seen who this God is yet, but we'll continue to build that case 2 weeks from now, May 3rd. We'll keep going with 5 more M's of apologetics. If you have any questions, I'd be glad to chat after this, but you are dismissed.